Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, or whenever you happen to be listening to this, welcome to the Film Realist Podcast, the film and TV podcast from a complete nobody. That is hopefully for somebody. My name is Kyle Naranya, and welcome to episode 204, where on this week's episode of the podcast, I am going to be reviewing the newest Star Wars film. It's only been 7 years, but we have Star Wars back on the big screen. That is, of course, The Mandalorian and Grogu. But that's not all. I am also going to be giving my spoiler thoughts on the final season of The Boys. Time codes will be listed in the description should you want to hop around. And because The Boys has concluded, it will be spoilers only. You have been warned. But let's dive into a galaxy far, far away with my non-spoiler thoughts on The Mandalorian and Grogu.
Not a lot to go on. What's the play?
I want you to go to Nau Hutta and meet with the Hutts. They've agreed to lead us to him.
What's in it for them?
Their nephew is being held against his will by another crime syndicate on the Outer Rim.
Just before getting into Star Wars, The Mandalorian, and Grogu, it's relevant to talk about when this show debuted. The first season of The Mandalorian was well received by everybody. It introduced this new character, as well as obviously Baby Yoda, who didn't have a name. And then a month later, we would get what was the last theatrical-going Star Wars experience until now, which was The Rise of Skywalker. Star Wars is in a very different place now. With Disney Plus launching exclusively all these different shows, it has diluted the overall Star Wars brand, and what used to be an event has turned into just more things. Obviously, there are the outliers, such as Andor, Maul, Shadow Lord. There have been other great stuff, the bringing back the Clone Wars, as well as Star Wars Rebels, but that was actually just on regular TV. And now, 3 seasons into The Mandalorian, and what was supposed to be season 4, is being presented to us as a film. And that is unfortunate, because the precedent for this had already been set by Moana 2. That film was supposed to be a series on Disney Plus, but streaming services, specifically one like Disney Plus, wasn't really making the money that they were hoping they would with their original programming. So they scrunched together what was supposed to be a season of TV and made it into a movie. And if you want to know what I think about Moana 2, check out that episode of the podcast. But we've done this already, and we're doing it again with arguably the most important brand under the Disney banner outside of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. We are getting The Mandalorian and Grogu, and while the budget may or may not be what is equivalent to the other theatrical films we've had in the Skywalker saga, it is really sad that this is what we're getting from Star Wars on the big screen. If you are somebody who can watch something and notice when stuff's cut out, you're going to have a really hard time with this. The Mandalorian character is a small screen character who audiences have spent the last 7 years getting to know. Grogu is an iconic character for being the only other Yoda outside of Yoda and Yaddle, a species we know very little about, and that just goes to show what they've decided to focus on. The father and son dynamic between those two characters is one that's relevant, especially if you're Pedro Pascal. This movie, however, feels like a made-for-TV movie or a streaming movie trying to be passed onto the big screen. There are elements of this that will entertain. It is fun, but it is emblematic of what Star Wars has become for a major audience, which is disposable. This is a story that feels truncated in its overall narrative, and there's something to be said now. Jon Favreau and Dave Filoni, somebody I absolutely adore, what Dave Filoni was able to do within the animated genre, expanding on so many elements of what we had in the expanded universe, bringing it over, and really diving into what the Force could be. Interestingly enough, the only other time we really looked at this at all was in The Last Jedi. But Star Wars, The Mandalorian, and Grogu is just episodes of a television series chopped up into pieces, and you can see the seams. And the biggest problem with that is you feel when things are missing. There is a scene with one of the characters where he outlines how he feels as essentially his modus operandi. Here is why I'm like this. 5 minutes later, he says it again. Relationships are pushed to have further meaning when we haven't spent the time that you would expect through the run of a series. This movie is just over 2 hours long. And what you get with that is a very quick-paced story that has a massive e-brake in it, which is not necessarily something that I think a lot of people won't enjoy because of what it chooses to focus on. And if you're a longtime fan of things connected to Pedro Pascal, it will feel very familiar to another property that he's been in. This movie is fun. It is cool to see The Mandalorian on the big screen. But one of the biggest expectations of the big screen is you are going to get the spectacle that deserves to be there. If you went to see this in IMAX, I'm really sorry for you. Regardless of having the resources to make this a theatrical going experience, outside of Rod of the Hutt and the other huts that we see, the visuals of this feel as if they were designed for television. And what is incredibly annoying is knowing where Jon Favreau has come from. He is somebody who created the look with everyone else that worked on Iron Man 1, what the MCU would become. His work with The Jungle Book and The Volume and how we have produced affordable, big pun intended, Star Wars shows that can be put onto streamers is seen here. This movie, and I hate calling it that, but that is what it is, has about three sets. And the way that you can see that there are three sets is because they are only connected together with visual effects. We have three locations because that is what this movie can afford. There is almost no ensemble whatsoever. You have two other main characters outside of some of the antagonists. There are barely any humans in the movie, and we don't get to dive into any real relationship in any meaningful way. The status quo is presented. Jon Favreau himself has said that this film does not require you to have seen any of the seasons of the television show, and I don't necessarily disagree with him, but when you are jumping off of three seasons of TV to a feature film, the investment of that time should be paid off. And it's not. Where these characters start and where they end at the end of the movie, it doesn't really feel like this journey was worth going on whatsoever. Like so much of Star Wars, it just sort of feels like another adventure. It is not adding to the mosaic of The Mandalorian that this is near the end game. No, this is just the adventure that we happen to be watching with them, and it happens to be on the big screen. I legitimately do feel that this story, if it were expanded upon in the way that they had initially planned season 4 to be, it would have been much more meaningful, specifically because of the dynamics between the main characters and how they meet each other. There is an evaluation of the different interpersonal dynamics presented within one's family, whether that be through adoption or blood lineage, that you could really explore. And in Star Wars, blood relations are really not necessarily something that is new for this franchise. It's been important, thus why the 9 films were dubbed the Skywalker Saga. This movie is underwhelming. The visuals are fun. The choreography does feel as if it was designed to be on the smaller screen. Sets are only so long because then they are extended with the power of the volume. There may have been times when they actually did go to real locations, but the muddiness of the cinematography of this movie just leaves me wanting more. The mixed feelings that I felt sitting in the theater with my popcorn and my Coke Zero, obviously not a sponsor, however, that'd be incredible, is this is what we get now from Star Wars. Say what you will about the 5 films we got from 2015, or no, 4 films. No, it's 5. From 2015 to 2019. Is that what it was? Wow, really? That's crazy that we got so many. I'm just realizing that now. But we had Star Wars, Force Awakens, the debut of this new trilogy, The Last Jedi, Rogue One, and then, you know, you got your Solo and your Rise of Skywalker, but they offered an expectation, and at minimum, they felt like a theatrical going experience. Star Wars is a movie theater brand, and I hate referring to them that way, but Disney Plus has really diminished what this franchise has meant to so many people. I commend Pedro Pascal for making Din Djarin a character that a generation of kids are going to be attached to. but it's unfortunate that the theatrical going experience that these kids are going to get is something like this. That may not be the worst Star Wars movie we've ever had, but it is nowhere near the best. That will do it for non-spoilers. There's a lot to get into in spoilers, so make sure you don't skip it once you've seen the film for yourself.
Mandalorian, still priceless on the black market.
But what even more is knowing we have shamed you forever.
We know the Mandalorian creed. You would be outcast for letting an enemy see your face.
Not if you all die.
So we see the Mandalorian and Grogu on another adventure looking to take out another Empire sympathizer, sort of running as his mob. And it's the scene we've seen from the AT-ATs in the Super Bowl clip, and I've definitely reacted to it. And he's working very closely with the New Republic on the side. It's still sort of tangential, and it's funny that in Andor, the show put such a focus on actually how the government works and the rise of the rebellion and the impact of fascism from the Galactic Empire. And we've seen so little of it actually within The Mandalorian, outside of, you know, the X-Wings. But one of my favorite elements, because I am, of course, a beloved fan of, I shouldn't say I'm a beloved fan, but I am a huge fan of Star Wars Rebels. And my favorite element in this is that Steven Bloom gets to be Zeb from Star Wars Rebels as what seems to be like the Mandalorian's partner, and they work a lot together. And that's where you get the visual effects budget outside of Rod of the Hutt is with the creation of Zeb. And we're working with Sigourney Weaver, who I love Sigourney Weaver. She is an iconic actress within the realm of science fiction. Ripley, and then of course, you know, Avatar, but in this, she's given nothing to do. I think she definitely shot in California, in the base that they may or may not have built, and she's delivering messages or missions to the Mandalorian. And then, you know, near the end of the movie, she gets to sit in an X-Wing cockpit, and of course, that's really cool. And then, I'm jumping way ahead, but we get to see all of the directors of the other episodes, because that's what we do. And then, of course, we see Appa from Kim's Convenience as well. But this story feels truncated from a season of television, specifically when looking at the relationship that is supposed to develop between Rod of the Hutt and the Mandalorian and Grogu, a character who was introduced, ironically, in the last movie that Dave Filoni worked on, Star Wars The Clone Wars, which was actually like episodes, I guess it would have been 2, 3, and 4, because the introduction, it's the continuity of Star Wars. You got to really be paying attention to make sure that you are aware of everything in the show. Anyways, the New Republic is looking for all of these former operatives or agents or generals or anything really that had to do with the Galactic Empire. The Mandalorian is taking missions. His relationship with Grogu is pretty much status quo from what we've seen before. And he has to go save Rod of the Hutt because a set of twins have information for him in order to find this other guy, a crime lord and a faction of the Galactic Empire. So he goes to the Hutts and they say where their nephew is, because he is actually the child of Jabba the Hutt. And we get to see Jeremy Allen White as an absolutely yoked Hutt, which is obviously visually very different from what we've seen before. And it's impressive to see how they were able to figure out how would a Hutt actually move quickly, because let's face it, through most of Star Wars canon, it's not something that we really get to see. And apparently it took almost 3 years for them to figure that out. It's a gladiator set. And, you know, if you've seen Thor Ragnarok, you sort of get it. And this is when you start to see what the episodes were going to be, which is the first mission, going to the gladiator planet, the mystery as to actually who the mob boss is, and we get action set pieces that likely were probably going to be the ending of each of the episodes. And then it turns out that the crime boss is actually the bad guy from the Emperor, or from the Empire, I should say. I guess he would have technically worked for the Emperor. And then we get Rada fighting the Mandalorian and then fighting some other aliens. And what's so funny to me about how streaming things, whether that be films or TV, are written now, is Netflix has been the main perpetrator of this crime, is over exposition, saying things that we're supposed to hear. And if we didn't hear it the first time, they're going to say it again. And Rod of the Hutt says why he feels he wants to stay on this planet, because he's cheered for and not feared because of his relationship to his dad. Interesting perspective, and I think that is compelling, given the Hutts, as we've known them, have been this mob boss family. About 5 minutes later, he says the exact same thing in a slightly different way. So if you're not paying attention the first time, you would have heard it the second time. But Dave, John, this is a movie. We're supposed to be paying attention. So why are you having the character say the exact same freaking thing 5 minutes later? All of the sort of ways that this is constructed feel like it is for TV. There's something that's been said in the past and in the present about the original Avengers films. And obviously Joss Whedon is a very touchy subject just in general. But the overall aesthetic of that film, as cool as it was to see the Avengers assemble, is it feels very TV. And the dialogue, the construction of this plot, was clearly designed that way. And it's becoming more and more clear that Dave Filoni really does struggle outside of the animated television medium. Because you have to tell a lot in animation. You can have incredible visuals because within the animated realm, you can break the laws of physics and have insane things happen because you're working in a different medium of television. Live action doesn't seem to work. I like a lot of the stuff that he's worked on, but I am no longer loving those things. It seems like the projects he's handed off, like Star Wars Bad Batch or Maul Shadow Lord, are sort of diving into their own aspects of the Star Wars world and giving us interesting shows. Maul Shadow Lord feels like it was inspired by Andor, and it just happens to be exploring characters that Dave did work on within Rebels and Clone Wars. But the people who are behind this, I'm sure, have great ideas, but are failing in the execution. The worst part about this movie is its predictability, and quite frankly, it's boring. The set pieces are things we've seen before. The action scenes are not overly inventive. Of course, the Mandalorian is a tactical fighter, but the use of him, it just starts to feel the same. He sort of scrambles around. He sometimes has his weapons. He sometimes doesn't. But we have to take them away so that way he doesn't overpower whoever he's going to be fighting, as opposed to presenting him with an antagonist who is at his physical capabilities. And we finally get one of those characters, but that character is a non-speaking person who, unfortunately, is the only sinister character, because the Hutts are the Hutts and we're not really afraid of them anymore, because we all saw Princess Leia in the metal bikini choke out Jabba however long that was. I want to say 43 years ago. So this movie, it's really... I did not go in with the expectation that I wasn't going to like this. I like a lot of The Mandalorian, and there's a bunch of it I also don't like. I think the character's really interesting in the way that they've brought in the Mandalorian lore and explore that cinematically through television. But the limits of the volume of what they're going to put into their shows, and friend of the show Rob Keyes has talked about this, that Star Wars shows should be prestige television. The Mandalorian may have started out that way, but it has slowly fallen down a hill, and we're not interested anymore because of the way that it's treated as though it is disposable. This isn't an absolutely must watch. This is the continuation of The Mandalorian and Grogu's story in a way that it just happens to follow three seasons of TV. There's not a moment in this that feels necessarily like there's been substantial growth. The only element of that whatsoever, and I found this incredibly ironic, is when the Mandalorian gets critically injured, Grogu then has to take care of himself. And if you are a fan of Pedro Pascal, as I said in non-spoilers, and have watched other things he's worked on, this is a sequence that has to have been inspired by The Last of Us. When Joel gets injured and you get to play as Ellie going around, thankfully there's no David pedophile in the Star Wars world, but it is very cool to see what the puppet is capable of, whether CG's used in there to assist, of course, it probably is. I like the Grogu character, but one of the reasons that Yoda is so beloved, yes, he obviously looks incredibly funny, is how that character talked and his demeanor and his relationship with the Force and Luke and Obi-Wan. Grogu nods and shakes his head, and yes, is absolutely adorable to see a younger version of Yoda's species, but there's only so much you can do with that. I've seen a lot of people talk about that this is very much like something you would have seen from Jim Henson and the Muppets and Sesame Street. And I think that's true, but its purpose overall in the story is developing Grogu's independence. That's the only thing of significance in this movie at all. We get to see the Mandalorian do more things, and I like the Mandalorian, but at least with a trilogy of episodes or most well-executed television series, you see the growth, or at least characters dealing with the struggles presented to them and seeing how they overcome them in an interesting way. This movie doesn't do those things. It just sort of exists. Is it bad? I'm gonna say no, but underwhelming, unrewarding for a long-time Star Wars fan. It just exists. And to feel that way about Star Wars when you've grown up with it, and I understand and I can hear the comments now that this is made for kids, and I will, to my last breath, argue the fact that just because something is maybe made for children doesn't mean it gets a pass on less execution. Jon Favreau and Dave Filoni have talked about the past, and why I love what Rian Johnson did with Star Wars in The Last Jedi is he pushed it forward. I am tired of constantly going backwards with this franchise. Tony Gilroy understood that while this is in the Star Wars world, I'm going to tell you an interesting story. It happens to be in Star Wars, but that's sort of after the fact. Can we do anything like that in anything else, please? I'm done with The Mandalorian, and I'm done with Grogu. I don't need to see any more from them, and that is because of these three seasons and this movie. This only exists in theaters because there was the chance it could make money. Because the streaming platform, as much as Netflix tries to buy everything, is not what it's designed for. Just like so many other things, eventually the bills are going to come, and I don't know if streaming's going to have the money to support it when you just keep making things and maybe not bringing money in. It's so annoying because I love Star Wars, and I would love to have been wowed. This will work if you are expecting very little, but for me, at this point, that's just not good enough anymore. We need new creatives in there. Are we actually going to get any of the announced Star Wars films moving forward? I sincerely doubt it. They continue to announce things, and then nothing happens. We know we are getting Star Wars Starfighter. That has a release date. That film's been made. Is it going to address a lot of my criticisms that Star Wars, The Mandalorian, and Grogu delivered? I'm unfortunately going to assume no. My only hope is I'm a big fan of Jonathan Tropper and what he's worked on, specifically Warrior and Banshee. And Sean Levy knows how to make an entertaining film, to say the least. I'm not going to get into his massive filmography at this point because that is not what this episode is about. Let me know what you thought of Star Wars and The Mandalorian in the comments, but that will do it for this review. Now it's time to dive into my full spoiler thoughts on The Boys Season 5.
I didn't want to do that. I'm going to call an ambulance, okay?
I wouldn't bother. It's all right, Huey. I gave you no choice. I wasn't gonna stop.
One of the funniest things about a show coming to an end is you either have fans who have been paying attention the whole time, or you have people who have sort of been in and out of the conversation, and then decide to weigh in on the series finale. And The Boys has definitely not been one of those shows that's been political, and its evaluation of society has never been relevant and just continues to become more and more irrelevant. Or, in fact, it's the opposite, and the show has become incredibly prophetic in a way that I don't even think we appreciated when it was coming out, and that there are certain people who didn't really know what the show was being a parody of from the very beginning. Which is, of course, what did happen if you've been following The Boys for its 5 seasons over the 7 years. And that is one of the funniest aspects of evaluating this final season, is I was having a conversation with my wife about shows coming to an end and how you feel about it. And in the streaming era, things usually take a really long time. And the major delay of this series was the writer strike and the actor strike, which did cause a delay between seasons 3 and 4. But ultimately, 5 seasons of television in 7 years is a massive achievement in the day and age we live with television now, which is just absolutely ridiculous. But overall, I thought this was a very effective season. There are elements of this season that I did not appreciate, which is when you know that other projects are on the way and a show not delivers a backdoor pilot, because of course Eric Kripke is aware of how to execute those, because there were at least 2 in the run of Supernatural, but there is an introduction to the Compound V version 1, V1, introduced in this season. And that, to me, is the most annoying element of how they decided to kill Homelander in the season. I don't have an issue with the main story of it, because we know that Soldier Boy would be somebody who was given V1, but the introduction of characters that are going to be in Vought Rising really did bother me. If we're going to explore Vought's history, which we know we are going to do in another show, it would have been much more compelling to have that story woven in with characters we had seen already. Whether that was Homelander and Soldier Boy going to look into Stormfront's history, a character we've already met, that really would have explored the relationship between them and Stormfront and them with each other, which the show did deliver in a certain way. I like the idea that there was constantly a different plan in how to kill Homelander. He becomes this worldwide threat after barely surviving, or I guess it would have been Soldier Boy barely surviving the plague or the virus that they had developed. And then V1 was the solution. So there's a back and forth, almost a chess game, which is not abnormal within The Boys' world. I thought that was really entertaining and worth the investment of the 8 episodes. What I didn't like was that Gen V established how powerful Marie was as a character. Somebody, as a fan of Avatar The Last Airbender, that I would say is a bloodbender, a character that would feel like she would have to be important when she can affect characters on a microscopic level. Regardless of the strength that Homelander may have had, it feels like an absolute waste of time that that character never even got the ability to try to take down Homelander. It went, hey, want a giant, what's the word I'm looking for, red herring? Oh, just kidding. They're going to be in 2 scenes, and the overall payoff of those 2 shows coming together was not rewarding at all. And to me, that was one of the most annoying parts of this show, was you assumed there was going to be some sort of payoff with our Gen V characters finally becoming into the big world of The Boys itself. And no, they're just sort of there in the background. I do like the relationship between Marie and Annie, but so much of that dynamic has happened off screen. So they tell each other how they feel, Marie being the person that really does help motivate Annie to want to do the right thing, and she's rewarded with the thought that she was not a letdown when actually meeting Marie. But those characters aren't given anything to do outside of, hey, be the same people that we saw in Logan, take people to Canada, which, you know, we've seen before. At the end of the day, this season is about the main cast of The Boys and Homelander and Deep and Black Noir and those main characters and the conclusions that we come to with their stories. The one element that I didn't appreciate was the integration of the supernatural cast really did feel like one-offs. There are moments throughout this show that feel not as if they're filler, but that they're part of a larger story we just hadn't been exploring. Whether that be the Teen Titans equivalent or former heroes who are now retired. There is a way in which that could have been woven, I think, more naturally into the season overall. But I didn't hate seeing Castiel and Sam, of course, Jared Padalecki and Misha was really fun. Of course, their back and forth with Soldier Boy was entertaining because it's incredibly different from what we've seen from the entire, 16-year run of Supernatural. The main cast was incredible in this show. I've seen criticism that Karen Fukihara getting the ability to talk was sort of enabling, or it was a criticism because the character was mute up until this point. I understand loving that we had a character who was unable to speak and that her method of communication was some form of sign language and that was baked into the trauma of the character. I totally understand that. However, the emotional payoff of her relationship with Frenchie because of being able to yell for him at the end of the season, as well as Kimiko and Frenchie's love for each other and the back and forth truly using those two characters as well as Annie and Huey and what this world is going to be, what is worth fighting for, and having those two characters look at their future in an entirely different way. And having Frenchie be the boy who died and the purpose that that serves narratively as well as emotionally to Kimiko in completing the arc of who this character was, somebody who was tormented through life in cages, ultimately becomes the reason they save the world because of the love that she's had and the back and forth that they have with Sister Sage, who is obviously incredibly clinical and somebody who is only intellectual and doesn't look at anything emotionally. They serve just as much as Annie and Huey as the beacons of light for hope. Because if you are going to fight to the death to save the world and your loved ones, there needs to be quite literally that light at the end of the tunnel that you're going to get through this mission and you are going to defeat Homelander. That is to say, I don't love the choreography of the fight within the White House. I think it serves its purpose. It's incredibly predictable. There's a brutality that I wish we maintained because one of the elements, this being a prime series, as well as something like Invincible, is the shock and awe of the brutality, the blood, the guts, the grossness, the brutalism in which they defeat and kill characters. But Homelander in this season, his overall role in the series as somebody who was this beacon of light for the heroes and how his fall through madness becomes comical in a way that the viewer understands that this character is truly lost. There's a rule within fiction that if you kill for nefarious purposes, it's very rare that you can kill and sort of get away with it and then ultimately not have an untimely demise of yourself. But the battle between the Butcher and Homelander, we knew that this is where it was going. And the idea that they use the idea of Soldier Boy's irradiation ability to take out Homelander. I didn't love the idea of Soldier Boy getting fridged. Quite literally, but I get what they were trying to do symbolically with Homelander doing that to him. But the emotional payoff of that fight and Billy being the one to ultimately take down Homelander and also the symbology of Ryan being a part of that. Earlier in the season, he was nearly killed by his father and that the guy who wants to be his father, even after everything that's happened, he chooses to not be with any of them. And those things need to happen because of who Billy Butcher is as a person. While he may be doing things for altruistic reasons, he's a terrible person, and his demise at the end of the season and the end of the show is something that needed to happen. It does, and you would have heard a clip from it leading into this, really show that regardless of the experience that Huey had throughout this entire series, that he stayed true to who he was, and that believing in the optimism and the future of what could be is what pushes Huey Campbell to be the main character that ultimately does save the world. Yes, Billy Butcher is the guy who kills Homelander, of course, with the help of Ryan and Kimiko, but the virus that would have killed every soup, which includes Annie and Kimiko, is stopped by Huey, who ultimately has to kill Billy. And I respect that series finales are often felt as not meeting expectations. You have a really high bar depending on your love of the series. And what I liked about this is emotionally where the characters are left off feels like the place that they should be. There's none of this, but wait, there's more. We have a series that's a prequel coming up, but all the main characters' stories have natural conclusions, and the way in which they're delivered is the way that you need to do that. The way in which Homelander is killed when it happens in the series. We also, of course, have the death of the Deep, which was set up earlier. It might be too predictable, and I would understand that criticism, but sometimes being predictable means the audience is on board on where the show is going to go. Getting the Deep to be killed by the ocean, the thing that he loves, because of the terrible things that he's done, and having Billy be the one to take down Homelander, and it not being anybody else, and Huey being the one to take down Billy, it is a natural progression of where these characters have come from and then where they go. MM getting back to his family, taking Ryan in, being quite literally the mother's milk for the boys and understanding where that came from. Emotionally, I felt satisfied on where the characters are. Over predictability is a criticism I would understand, as I've said, but the performances in this show delivered time after time, regardless of the show being inconsistent in its final season, it is far and away not the worst series finale. It is not the best series finale, but looking at the gauntlet that this series was, it was a satisfying conclusion to one of Prime Video's best shows of all time. Did you watch The Boys Season 5? What did you think of the series finale? Make sure to let me know in the comments. That will do it for my thoughts on The Boys Season 5. Now let's get to the news of the week.
Tonight at 11.
Doom! We're sitting on top of the story of the century here.
But that's not all, folks. Here's the real blockbuster. Brace yourselves. You might want to sit out.
And I need all of you to stop what you're doing and listen.
The first place to start is that Chris Cantwell has confirmed that he's joining Lantern Season 2. Now, the first season was written by Tom King and Damian Lindelof, as well as Chris Mundy. So not sure if Chris Mundy is going to be moving forward with the series, but what's really awesome, given the fact that these things have sort of been teased, is that it's looking like we are going to be getting a second season already. With the two trailers that have been released so far for this, if you want to hear my full thoughts on the second trailer, the official teaser 2, or the official trailer, I did jump on with Andy Babacht and all the DC Studios crew at Multiverse of Color to talk about it there. But I'm really excited about Lanterns. I think Kyle Chandler and Aaron Pierre as Hal Jordan and Jon Stewart seem to be presenting the dynamic that you would expect from those characters. And Lanterns as a show delivering a two-timeline story where we're getting something in 2016 and 2026, we are going to fill out the world of the DCU within the Green Lanterns or other Lanterns genre, or I guess space, is really exciting. I love the idea of getting to see something grounded and rooted while also having the sci-fi elements of the Lantern Corps on HBO. This is a network that is known for its supernatural elements in one of its biggest shows of all time. And I go on to talk so much more about this with DC Studios, but season two looking like it's going to happen already before the show even premieres in August, which is awesome. The only other main thing of news that I wanted to talk about is both Man of Tomorrow things. Now, of course, we know that David Cornsweet is going to be in Supergirl. We've seen clips of this. They released another one earlier this week of him meeting Kara for the very first time, maintaining that she arrives on Earth as a late teenager. And of course, he's a grown man. But what's awesome about Supergirl returning in Man of Tomorrow does bold with the connection that I have argued that when we see Argo, which is where Kara Zor-El is from, being bubbled up, we know that the villain of Man of Tomorrow is Brainiac. And there are connections, of course, to the Gary Frank, Geoff Johns, Superman, Brainiac storyline that I have argued, which was also adapted into a film called Superman Unbound, which explored the relationship between Clark, Kara, and Brainiac. It was a very good animated feature, which also did have Matt Bomer, who was once going to be Superman in a live action film. So it looks like more of those elements are going to be brought into the film, which I like. It's great to see that Kara, even after her debut in Superman, had a shadow cameo in Peacemaker season 2 after her feature film. This is not a character that's just going to go away. I don't think she needs to be a main character of Man of Tomorrow, but it does seem like there is going to be some sort of narrative carrying forward between the two movies, which of course James has already dubbed are within what we can call the Superman saga. On to another character, which is we have had another cast member join the film. I didn't write an article about this, but it is very heavily rumored that he is going to be playing. I can't find the name of the actor as I'm saying this, which I'm annoyed by, but it sounds as if Martian Manhunter will also be debuting in Man of Tomorrow. I don't find this shocking because Superman introduced three characters who are likely, maybe not Guy, but at least two characters who are probably going to be in the inevitable Justice League. Aaron Pierre is already going to be coming back. Isabella Merced is going to be coming back. And Martian Manhunter as a character, just on his perspective on what it means to be an extraterrestrial on Earth, is inherently different than Clark's. If they do go with the New Frontier version of the character, which is my favorite interpretation, where he's been on Earth since the 50s, which does go with one of my favorite elements of what Superman did, is it established that this world has existed. The idea of metahumans have been a part of it for nearly 3,000 years. And why not have a character who's had a very different life, and because of people like Superman, is brought to the public eye as his own hero? That would be something that I would really like to see. I love John Jones, specifically after watching, of course, Justice League and Justice League Unlimited. That's a character that I really, really like and that I want to see more from. Is it sounding like there's a lot of people in this movie? Yes, but I did have that hesitancy leading into the first film and was pleasantly surprised in the way that all those characters were woven into the story as a whole. That's pretty much it for news. I don't think there was any other major things. Of course, the Batman cast was laid out, and I gave my thoughts really in depth on who I think a lot of those people are playing. I will briefly say this here. I do think that Sebastian Stan, also after what he said today when he was talking about playing different characters and the makeup he was going to wear, oh, I don't know who that sounds like. Of course, it sounds like Harvey Dent. I do think that Scarlett Johansson is playing Gilda Dent. And I do think that Tywin Lannister will also be his father, which the reason I'm thinking for that is you can have a Charles Dance is obviously his name, but a connection to the history of Gotham as a world. We learned so much about the Arkhams and the Waynes in the first The Batman, and it leads me to believe at least that we're going to continue to explore the history of this place, which also leads me to Court of Owls. A lot of people like the idea of looking at Mr. Freeze, and it's just a character I don't think fits in the world of Matt Reeves' epic crime saga. We know it's going to be a mystery of sorts, but we also know that, I believe it's pronounced Sebastian Koch, will be in the film. Could he be Hugo Strange? Could he be the lead of the Court of Owls? I don't know. This cast looks amazing. Brian Tyree Henry does not have a current role listed. I love the idea of him playing Harvey Dent with Jeffrey Wright. I think those two actors going back and forth would be amazing. And we know we are going to see more of the GCPD. Officer Martinez is back. Jamie Lawson is back as Bella Real. What is the world like with Batman being a symbol for hope? We have to see what the GCPD thinks of that. Bat Signal feels like an obvious answer, but I'm incredibly excited. The Batman Part 2 is my most anticipated film of 2027. That will do it for the news. Now let's get to listener mail and question of the week responses.
Can I ask you a question?
Just one?
There's something I've been meaning to ask you.
I ask the questions, you answer the questions.
Why do you ask questions to which you already know the answers?
Did that count as a question?
Yes.
Damn it.
Last week's question of the week was, what Disney Plus series do you think deserves a film? Jermaine Jones writes in, my comment about Mando. Look, I sat through three of the last Star Wars movies and never watched them again. No one is asking for any type of spinoff of any of those characters. Mando wasn't the great thing everybody thought he was, but you enjoy the show if you like this. Star Wars fans, everything doesn't have to connect to a bigger Star Wars world. Thanks. The Disney Plus show that should get a movie is X-Men 97. It's fantastic and gives the respect to Cyclops and Rogue that they deserve. Yeah, I think more animation is always a good thing, Jermaine. Thank you for writing in. Scotty Cameron writes, the best way to describe the Marvel presentation is TV movies. I agree. Question of the week. It's difficult because so many of the spun-off from the movies like Andor and Hawkeye, The Mandalorian is the only Star Wars thing that is worth getting a movie. On the Marvel side, Falcon and the Winter Soldier got two movies. If I had to choose, it might be Daredevil or Moon Knight. Daredevil would be a neat opportunity to use more heavy visual effects. Moon Knight, I just like an exploration of him as we do more street-level stuff. Okay. And then Legacy commented on the Mortal Kombat side. I'm definitely a biased audience member. As an aside from one of the protagonists hitting my people need me in the conclusion out of nowhere, I had no complaints when I watched it. It felt pretty on par with the typical post-2008 Mortal Kombat story mode. Now, am I just a Johnny Cage mark and will always add points to the review to see more Cage I see on screen? Who's to say? Of course, who doesn't? I thought Carl Urban was great, but you can listen to that whole episode for those thoughts. Dylan writes in, I think One Last Kill was in reference to Frank ending his own life, not some changes to how he punishes or reference that ding-dong thug as far as Disney Plus series deserving a movie. I kind of have to say none. I feel like every Disney Plus series is usually already part of a larger world, and it doesn't necessarily need theaters. I guess, though, maybe Daredevil or Punisher are honestly probably a new Muppet movie since Disney owns that as well. Yeah, I don't disagree with that, Dylan. A on TikTok says Moon Knight deserved a film rather than a TV show. Sean says Daredevil. Skadoodle, depending on whether or not they want to make any money. Interesting, okay. And then Jay Doherty says Maul, Shadow Lord. And then on YouTube, NC41125 says Gravity Falls. It's annoying because, yes, a lot of their stuff has, of course, been adapted from theatrical characters and then put onto the small screen. Personally, I would love to see Ahsoka as an animated film. I think the visuals would be more interesting, and I quite frankly think the story that the first season had might have played better on the big screen condensed. Ironically, the opposite of what The Mandalorian was. Now on to this week's question of the week, which is inspired by Spider-Noir. I'm incredibly excited to see what Nicolas Cage is going to do as Ben Reilly, the human being in live action. And that is really cool because we are getting more of the Spider-Verse as we wait for Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, Beyond the Spider-Verse. Which Spider character would you like to see get their own series? Any of the main spider people can be equivalent for this, or if you want to get a really crazy deep cut, you're welcome to do that as well. To answer the question of the week, you can email the podcast, filmrealistpod@gmail.com. You can comment below directly on Spotify and YouTube, or you can add the hashtag QOTW on any of the social medias. I check them all, so if you answer, I will not miss it. Thank you to everybody for listening to the Film Realist podcast. If you are watching on YouTube, please like and subscribe. If you are listening on the Multiverse of Color, you can check out all of the articles that I have written there, and make sure to follow on your preferred podcast platform so you don't miss next week's episode when I review Spider-Man Noir. No, it is Spider Noir. I wonder if Prime Video can't have the word Spider-Man in it. It's got to be a legality thing, right? Who's to say? My name is Kyle Naranya, and I will see you next time.